morning, sir. I'd like to go ahead and call the Senate Finance Committee to order. It's February 26, 2019, 9 a.m. We have full quorum today. My co-chair, Senator Von Imhoff, Senator Bishop, Senator Wilson, Senator Olson, Senator Machicki, Senator Hoffman, Senator Schauer, Senator Wilikowski, myself, Stedman. We are also joined by the Senate President Giesel, Stevens, and Costello senators, and there may be other senators that come in during the presentation. Today's meeting is going to be a budget overview by Legislative Finance Director. We've asked, and for those at home, Legislative Finance is a nonpartisan arm of the legislature that helps us analyze and work with budgets. So the presentation will be an overview of the governor's submitted budget. They also work with us in how we put our budget together in the legislature, for those, again, watching at home. And if I could have Mr. Teal come forward, please, introduce himself for the record, and take us to his presentation. But maybe before he starts his presentation, he could take a brief moment and mention to the public the size of his staff and what they kind of do, so it'll put this more in context. Mr. Teal.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm David Teal, Director of the Legislative Finance Division. I have a staff of about six analysts and some IT people that give us the support we need to run our budget system that produces the budget bills for the full legislature, or part of the bills anyway. The legal services also contributes to that substantially.
Can you put the mic back just a little bit?
So we are nonpartisan. We provide assistance primarily to the finance committees, but we're available to the full legislature for any questions regarding fiscal matters of any kind, whether it's past capital projects or help with preparing current amendments to appropriation bills, just whatever assistance we can provide in the budget process. I've been doing that in my position for about 20 years now, and I have to say that I've never seen a budget rollout quite like this one. You knew that the December 15th budget submitted by the governor was a placeholder. And overviews to before February 13th were primarily an overview of the fiscal situation rather than the budget itself, because neither OMB nor us had a real budget in front of you. Well, that certainly delayed the start of the budget analysis, but since the budget was released on February 13th, you've worked overtime catching up on that. When I say rollout's different, what I really mean there is that the Senate Finance Committee has spent more time and talked in much greater detail about the operating budget than I can ever recall. So I don't think it's really necessary for me to go through what you've already gone through with OMB on specific budget items, but I think it would be beneficial to take a step back and look at the policies and the principles that drive some of the governor's budget proposals. So the OMB website contains a video and a statement that accompany the release of the budget. And the governor set out five guiding principles that drove his budget preparation. The first is that expenditures cannot exceed revenues is certainly true in the long run. I think we all know that. We've been using reserves, and you can't continue to do that. Back in January, I used this graph showing, it shows real per capita expenditures and revenue over time, and noted that expenditures equals revenue is simply a mathematical relationship with policy implications. There's no question here that the bar, when the bars are, which the bars represent expenditures of various kinds, it doesn't really matter. You can see on the legend what part of the budget they are. The background, the green, is revenue. And you can see that in recent years, expenditures have exceeded revenue. The black, way over there on the right, shows what happened when we added POMV, percent of market value, the payout from the permanent fund earnings reserve account was added to revenue. So we can see about a $2 billion jump in 19, falling to about $1 billion here in FY20. This graph excludes permanent fund dividends, so you need to keep that in mind. But I think the real point is that there's no question here that revenues were insufficient to fund the budget for a number of years since FY13. So the question isn't, do expenditures exceed revenue? It's, do expenditures exceed revenue because expenditures are too high or because revenue is too low, historically low? And I'll let you be the judge of that. The OMB director said that the answer is obvious, that expenditures must be too high because they exceed revenue. But you can turn that around and just as well and say that revenues are too low because they're less than expenditures. I don't think you can answer the question until you review the entire budget, determine how much you want to spend, where you want to spend it, and then you can compare expenditures and revenue and decide how you want to address the deficit, if there is one. Don Ardwin said, the OMB director said, that the budget is built on core functions. It was built from the ground up. Some interpreted that statement as use of zero-based budgeting. It is not zero-based budgeting. If it were zero-based budgeting, your questions about the analysis of fiscal impact would be answered. You would have had the background papers necessary to justify any reductions to the budget or anything that remained in the budget. The director clarified later that it wasn't zero-based budgeting, it's core-based budgeting, and that agencies had prioritized the services they offer. It doesn't really matter what you call it. It seems apparent that many of you share my disappointment in the lack of evaluation and analysis to support the governor's proposals. Now, I think budget shouldn't simply be a math problem, that budgeting and policy are inseparable, and that you cannot make good policy decisions or good budget decisions without full information. All cuts are not equal, yet the common answer to your questions about why are you cutting this particular item have been, we have a deficit, or it's just a proposal. So going on to number three, maintaining and protecting our reserves is a goal you probably all share. But the budget pulls $436 million from the statutory budget reserve fund and from ADA reserves. The 19 budget is expected to pull less than $300 million from reserves. The one fourth principle is that the budget will not take additional funds from Alaskans through taxes or PFD. Yet it does not rely on existing state revenue to balance the budget. It pushes costs onto municipalities. It shifts revenue from municipalities. And some, if not all, of those costs and revenues are going to be passed on to citizens. So it's not direct, but it's likely consequence. And fifth principle, it must be sustainable, predictable, and affordable. But if expenditures equal revenues, and you're going to set that as a guiding principle, and revenue is volatile, as we know it is, how will the budget be any more predictable than oil prices themselves? Are we going to cut expenditures every time revenue falls? Are we going to increase the budget if every time revenue goes up? How are you going to respond to a $50 oil situation? Come back in special session? I don't see how simply setting expenditures equal to revenue makes things more predictable. And perhaps I'm too literal on this. I understand each of us can interpret words different ways. But it seems to me that the governor took two of the three normal traditional budget balancing tools off the table. He said the $1.6 billion deficit would be filled without new revenue and without pulling money from reserves. I suspect that many people think that the budget is balanced because the governor cut $1.6 billion from spending, especially after seeing what happened to the Marine Highway System, the university, to Medicaid, senior benefits, the university. But here's a short fiscal summary on slide five that I think helps put the budget in perspective. It's unrestricted revenue, and it's a very short fiscal summary because I think that's all you need. We don't have any technical issues with the OMB presentation of the budget. Our numbers all agree. We vary on presentation, and I think it's important to note that presentation means a great deal in this. There's a big difference between treating permanent fund dividends as off budget, as the governor wants to treat them. And our view is that this isn't like your own budget that you can simply do at home. When you're dealing with state budgets, the people, the legislature, should know what's in it, all of what's in it, all expenditures, all revenue. And so we think permanent fund dividends should be treated as a budgeted item. But here we have, in FY19, revenues were about $5.5 billion. They're lower now. In FY20 are expected to be lower, and that's because in 19 oil prices are projected to be about $68 versus $64 in FY20. So revenue is down a little over $200 million. Appropriations were at $5.7 billion and have fallen by about $73 million in FY20. So the surplus we expect for 19 is $262 million. And the surplus the deficit is 262, and we've got a deficit of $428 million in FY20. That, of course, is before we take the governor's revenue measures into account, where we have a shift in property tax, where the state would be taking statewide property tax or petroleum property tax. Adds about $420 million, and then you've got another $28 million in shared taxes that the state would retain instead of handing out to communities. So you get a budget that covers the deficit, brings you to a small surplus, essentially zero deficit. Now, in the overview publication, I said that the governor would find it very difficult to reduce agency operating costs, and he may find that he has to cut where the money is and or shift costs onto local governments. I don't think that statement was going very far out on a limb. Slide 6 shows what the agency operating budgets were in 19 and compares them to what they are in proposed to be in FY20. It shows that the agency operations, and this is excluding Medicaid and K-12, which are the big formula programs, it shows that FY19 appropriations were just over $2 billion. And the governor is proposing a 13% cut to that, or roughly $260 million. Despite campaign statements that $200 million or more could be cut with no impact on services because agencies had funded but unfilled positions, we could achieve efficiencies and several other savings that he hoped to accomplish. I believe that cutting $200 million from agency operations would be a big stretch. The governor exceeded my expectations. He cut $260 million instead of, which is far more than I expected, but is also far less than $1.6 billion. And admittedly, I did not foresee a 41% cut to the university budget. I did not foresee an end to the marine highway system as those in coastal Alaska know it. Now, the detail on slide 5 would drop us to a level that I don't want to get to today. I think you'll hit those in subcommittees. You've also done a lot of discussion of these items in the past week and a half. But I think it's worth pointing out a few things about the big cuts.
Before the first we go on to the next slide, we have a question from Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you, Chair Stedman. So, Mr. Thiel, what is noticeable to me is the Department of Education Early Development at $52 million and $56 million. For UGF funds, what about the formula funding, as in the $1 billion that we pay to the schools? Is that out of UGF funds? And why is that not included in this? I see this is just for the department, but reality, we have the whole statewide 53 districts that I'd like to consider. So where's the rest of the money for education?
When answering Senator Von Imhoff's question, if you could, for those watching at home, kind of talk about the forward funding mechanism that was in place in last year's budget and how that interties with your slide also.
Certainly, Mr. Chairman. In answer to Senator Von Imhoff's question, this is only the agency operations. It excludes Medicaid and K-12 because when we saw the big swoop graph, or whatever you want to call it, showing various expenditures, K-12, Medicaid are big formula programs, meaning that there's a statutory formula for allocating the money to school districts, or in the case of Medicaid, to providers, to eligible recipients of Medicaid services. So I took those off the slide because this is what most people think of as the day-to-day operating costs of state government. And so we were looking at, in those day-to-day operating costs of state government, how much are you cutting? How much is the governor proposing to cut? Now, in response to your question about education funding, last year that was funded by the legislature, signed by Governor Walker. So the FY20 funding, approximately between $1.2 and $1.3 billion, is already appropriated. It can't be vetoed. The Governor Walker had a chance to do that, didn't veto it. And the money is simply delayed. It had an effective date of FY20 and is available to school districts beginning July 1. You don't need to make an appropriation for K-12 this year at all. It's forward funded, pre-funded. In the governor's budget, he proposed to repeal that provision from last year, deleting not only the formula money, but an additional $30 million on top of the formula, and then replacing that with a prorated amount, roughly 75% of what the formula would have handed out. So a cut of approximately $300 million from K-12 funding. But because it was funded last year, if you simply reject that repeal and reject the replacement of new money, the money that was appropriated last year remains in the FY20 budget.
We'll follow up.
Thank you, Chair Stedman. So, Mr. Teal, I appreciate that presentation. So what I heard was the associated bill with the education funding, if the legislature chooses to accept the bill to repeal the formula funding for 2020 and instead put forward a new appropriation line, we have that liberty to do so. And is that the same with, you said you didn't include Medicaid on here as well. Is there also a bill appropriation interplay with that as well?
Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, there is an interplay, but not in the same way. And that's because education was passed with pre-funded or passed with a delayed effective date. Medicaid was not. Medicaid is strictly an FY20 appropriation. However, there are maybe statutes, there's certainly requests going along with Medicaid to reduce Medicaid funding. But later slides talk about the formula more than here. They're removed from this slide because I see those big formula programs as one of the areas where I said that's where the money is, and the governor may not be able to find the money he needs from these day-to-day operating expenses and may have to look to K-12 and to Medicaid. But he won't be able to find $1.6 billion in cuts from these $2 billion in operating costs.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To follow up on the supplemental for FY19, we have two supplementals, the 19 for $20 million and the 20 for $30 million. What triggers the distribution of the $20 million for FY19 to be dispensed to the school districts?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, there is no trigger for that. That money was simply available to districts on July 1st of FY19. The governor chooses to say it was not distributed and he's going to withhold it until the legislature takes some action on that money. So any trigger is a policy call rather than anything having to do with the availability of the money. It's there.
Let me put a finer point, I think, on Senator Hoffman's question. What's the latest date that those funds have to be dispersed to the communities? The school districts, I should say. After it's been appropriated and signed, passed by the legislature, signed by the governor?
Mr. Chairman, I think the expectation was that they would go out along with formula money beginning July 1st so that as money goes out monthly to school districts, that a portion of the $20 million would also be distributed. I don't know exactly what happened, but for some reason, the administration withheld the $20 million, saying that we'll use it in the true-up when we get a revised count, and then at the end of the year, we'll use that for true-up money. I guess you could argue that that's just fine, but the money has to go out before June 30th. But I don't know why you would withhold it until June 30th. I guess from a school district's perspective, if they have reserves and if they know that money is going to come in, they can get it June 30th and book the money and balance all their books after the close of the fiscal year. That's allowed. But I think they would all feel much more comfortable knowing that the money is on its way.
Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, just on the timing of when that money has been historically released, what have you ever seen a situation where a governor's just simply refused or waited until June 30th to release that those funds?
Through the chair, Senator, there may be instances of that. The document or the policy that governs this goes back to the state versus Fairbanks North Star Borough when Governor Sheffield withheld funds when oil prices fell. The result of that lawsuit was a legal ruling that says that the governor cannot withhold appropriated funds. He must distribute funds as they're appropriated, but I don't think it addressed when in the fiscal year they have to go. I think logically you want the money to go out so it actually can be spent. For many, if that were a grant, you would say, I need the money before June 30th. In fact, I want it as soon as it's available on July 1st, first day of the fiscal year. But I don't think the legal ruling went so far as to say it has to be by December 1st or by May 1st or something like that.
Do we have another question? Senator Schauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We have constitutional statutory obligations. We also have other things we spend money on that are not mandated that we just choose to. In your analysis, does legislative finance look at all at those obligations that we are required to do versus the things that we choose to do? And then a second question kind of related to one that was already asked. When we appropriate money as a legislature, is the governor required to spend all of that, or if there are things left over, does he have the ability to just not spend it?
Senator Schauer, through the chair. The governor doesn't have to spend all the money if there are good reasons that it can't be spent. For example, the VPSO program. The department says, we offered all the money to the grantees. These are the grants that we received. We fully funded all of them. We still have $3 million left. Then there's nothing that says that the governor has to spend that money. He can argue that I have no way to spend it. On the other hand, if the money can be spent, the governor can't unilaterally withhold that money. That was the court's ruling. And it must be spent as the legislature appropriated it. And I'm sorry, now I forgot what your first question was.
We'll try to ask one question at a time. We'll make sure everybody has ample time to ask all their questions, so make it easier for the participant at the end of the table.
Who's getting too old to remember things.
Well,
Senator Schauer, if you could repeat that first question, please.
And one question in two parts. So just when you did your analysis, as you go through it, did you look at constitutional, statutory obligations we have to pay, and then the other categories where we spend money that we just choose to? Is that anything that you look at through the process?
Through the chair, Senator Schauer, that's something that we do look at. For instance, we want to make sure that debt service, retirement costs, other things that affect the state's credit rating are paid. But for many years, people have tried to break the budget into the mandatory versus discretionary expenditures, hoping to control expenditures in that way. And the problem has always been this, that although education is a mandatory, a constitutionally mandated function of state government, nothing says how much you have to appropriate to it. So the governor, we have a formula that would hand out $1.2-something billion, and the governor can say, I think we meet our constitutional mandate by spending 75% of that amount. There's nothing in law right now that says that's either adequate or inadequate. That can only be addressed by a lawsuit, which with this level of cut, I would say it's highly likely that you would get a lawsuit regarding the adequacy of education funding if the governor's budget were to go through. So the answer to your question is that it's really difficult to break things into mandatory because they don't include amounts to spend. They just say, do this program. And statutes often say very similar things. You should do this, Ocean Rangers, you should have these programs, you must have these programs. But they don't say what level of funding goes with those programs.
Okay, we have another question. Seeing none, well, Senator Wilkowski and then Senator Machicki.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the base student allocation, is there any precedent for not funding to the level provided for in the statute for base student allocation?
Through the chair, there's a provision in statute that says if it occurs that you prorate. I don't think it has occurred intentionally. It may have occurred some of the times when, you know, more than 10, 15 years ago, there was an actual dollar amount appropriated. In recent years, the appropriations for education have always said the amount necessary to fund the formula, so that there has been no prorating. It may have happened years ago that there was not quite enough money to fund the full formula.
Senator Machicki.
I don't know.
Thank you. Mr. Teals, in a nutshell, just to clarify for the public, what you're saying is budget requests submitted by the districts can be up to $20 million. The $20 million appropriation is the law of the land today, but the governor is not breaking the law unless the funding is not provided by June 30th, 2019, unless the legislature changes the existing law. Is that correct?
Through the chair, that's correct.
Any other questions? Senator Schauer, did you have a question before we go to the next slide? Okay, I think this finishes up this slide. Okay, we'll go on, Mr. Teal, and continue.
Actually, if you want, I can go through some of these big cuts. I know that you looked at some of them.
That'd be nice. I wasn't hurrying. I thought you were done with the slide is why I had interjected questions. But go ahead and go through the slide, and when you're done with the slide, then we'll come back and have the committee members ask any questions they so choose.
Okay. In the Department of Corrections, you see a $30 million reduction. That is due in part to substitution of permanent fund money, the what we used to call permanent fund criminal funds. It's criminals don't get a PFD, and so when you have an increase in dividends the way we had last year, there are more of those funds available, and they were substituted in Department of Corrections. The primary reason for the reduction is the expectation that we would be sending 500 prisoners out of state, and that there were savings associated with that. We don't have good numbers on this. I, for instance, would like to know what's the criteria for identifying out-of-state prisoners, where are they located, what are the transportation costs, what are the costs of the psychiatric and physical exams that they would need to go, how much does it cost to move remaining Alaska prisoners around so that we can close down one prison instead of just operating all the prisons at below capacity. There are a number of things that you'd like to know to back this up. We don't know them. All we have is an estimate with no details. So our very abbreviated analysis based on what we do know is that I wouldn't be surprised to see a supplemental request of $7 million or more for the Department of Corrections, assuming things go as the governor proposes them. There's a cut here in health and social services, and as Senator von Imhoff noted, Medicaid's not on here. That's a big cut. But in addition to Medicaid, there's $87 million in cuts to other programs. Pioneers Homes may appear to be unharmed to those that look at combined GF, but I think you're aware that there was major reductions to the unrestricted general fund portion of their budget to be replaced with program receipts, basically the rent, the fees from those who occupy the rooms. So again, the agency hasn't provided the data we would need for full analysis of the impacts of that. Behavioral health loses about 80% of its budget. ATAP, the temporary assistance programs, down $2.5 million. Adult public assistance is down $14.7 million. $17 million for tribal assistance was eliminated, and $20 million in senior benefits was eliminated. So there are a number of the social services programs other than Medicaid that were substantially reduced in the governor's budget. The $57 million in transportation and public facilities is primarily the ferry system. They're funded only through October, which doesn't leave many options, as you've already discussed here, that if the marine consultant comes up with findings other than shut the ferry system down for coastal runs, there's no money here to implement any other option. The university is another example of zero impact in total GF, but I think you all understand that there was a 41% reduction in unrestricted GF, which is real money, and as the president testified, that cut of UGF is real money to them. Well, the ability to offset those cuts by increasing tuition is fantasy money. So those are the big cuts here. Unless there are questions, which may have been answered already.
So you're done with the slide? I know that. I'll take care of that. Yeah. Are you
yes.
done with the slide?
Yes.
Okay, Senator, well, thank you. First, we have Michiki, then Willikowski, and then was there a question on this side? Okay, we'll start with Michiki and then go to Willikowski.
Just a quick, I guess it's a little bit of a question, Mr. Chairman. I understand the reason and your logic for this slide, but I think it kind of puts a danger out there of a misunderstanding just because of the lack of it being an apples to apples. I just wonder if, and I know what's coming in the next slide, but I just wonder if we could also have this slide that includes the other reductions so that the public can kind of see it laid out. If this is the slide they referred to, they're going to have a fairly significant misunderstanding of the impacts of the budget document.
So you're asking for them to, for Ledge Finance to come back with a further inclusion on a slide to show the total cuts?
Include the information in the next slide, Mr. Chairman, which I think would give the public a better understanding of the overall impacts.
Right, I'll work with Mr. Teal on that and see if we can come up with something that's for the committee. Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hoffman.
On the Bishop. The ferry system cut, the governor, well, I guess DOT has stopped, the ferry system has stopped taking reservations after September 30th. And I don't know if you can answer this, but I mean, can the governor just do that on his own? We're the appropriating body. We haven't made that policy call to stop the ferry system. Can the governor just go ahead and unilaterally stop the ferry system from taking reservations after September 30th?
Through the chair, he did. I mean, I don't know what to tell you on that one. We know that they've testified that they are not taking reservations. It's true that as the appropriating body, you may appropriate money. If you appropriate the money, you get back into that situation of if you appropriate money to the Marine Highway System, he's obligated to spend it to run the Marine Highway System. But his argument is, I don't want the money and you shouldn't give it to me.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you. On that subject, before I get into my questions, he could also veto it, so, and I think that that's highly likely. But the question that I have, thank you, Mr. Chairman, is on public safety. Can you expound a little bit on the $3.2 million reduction, and then I have a request similar to one that was made on the fiscal impacts of legislation on a sheet of paper, and how that how each one of those particular pieces of legislation will affect this budget if passed, and the fiscal notes accompanying them, so that we as a legislature can get a better synopsis of the revenue that the governor is proposing in legislation.
Mr. Chairman, first to respond to your point that about putting a slide like slide 6 on the web or to the committee, I'd say that's already posted on our website. I don't have it in the slide deck, but it's on the website available to you or to the public so that you can see the full UGF changes, the total changes, the various other standard reports that we publish. Now, on DPS, you see a reduction of $3.2 million. Most of that, $3 million of it, is to the VPSO program. DPS is left essentially unchanged other than VPSO.
We should define the acronym so people can follow all the fancy.
Village Public Safety Officer Program, sorry.
And public safety was the first one? Department of Public Safety?
Yes. So, that's most of it. I don't know exactly where the other 262,000 is in that agency.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Senator Von Imhoff and then Senator Wilikowski. I think we just second. Did I skip you, Senator Bishop?
Yes, you did. Yes, go, Senator.
I'm fine.
Bishop, I'm good. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, Mr. Teal, I'm looking at executive branch-wide appropriations for $23 million. It's my understanding that the administration had lump-summed salary adjustments or salary increases for all the state employees taken from the different departments and kind of put them in one catch-all, this executive bride appropriations. Can you comment on that?
Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, you're referring, I think, to this last slide, 9, and way over here on the right, you see the executive branch-wide appropriations. That's $23 million. And the governor did decide to consolidate all salary adjustments in one area, in branch-wide, and then to allocate them later. We've asked OMB to provide us with the normal breakdown by allocation of all the salaries broken down into the various bargaining units, so that we expect to get that information this week. And as you go to subcommittees, I can't speak for the chairman, but I think what the subcommittees are expected to do is incorporate all that salary adjustment money in the agencies themselves. So by what you're seeing here is back to this slide.
Well, we should, yeah, let's keep our slides in order. And if there's a question that should be answered further down the deck, we'll just hold those questions. Otherwise, we're going to jump all over here.
Okay. If you'll see it, it's on this slide.
And again, it's something that you will probably address in subcommittee. Take it out of the branch-wide allocations and put that money in the agencies themselves.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Next question was Bishop Passer, or Wilikowski?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. The health and social services budget, there's been $1 million a month contract issued to WellPath, and the legislature never appropriated funds for that in 19, as far as I know. Where do those funds come from?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, the legislature did appropriate money for the Alaska Psychiatric Institute. And of course, the way you may look at it is, yes, but we appropriated money on the personal services line and some here on the travel line and so on and so on. But the decision to go to a contract may be opposed by bargaining units, but the governor's, the executive branch, has the freedom to move money among line items, so that if they choose to fulfill their responsibilities at API or anywhere else by contracting instead of hiring employees, they're allowed to do that.
Any other questions? Senator Schauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Have you reached out, or do you know, because we're talking about the ferry system being eliminated, but since we're talking about the item there in the budget, if they have a plan going forward versus just eliminating? I know that we're talking about it, but I was just curious if you might have reached out to see if they have other plans for the ferry operating past 1 October.
Through the chair, Senator Schauer, not that we know of. I was here when that question was asked of OMB, and I believe their response was, we've hired a marine consultant to look into this, and we'll see what he says. I don't know how that allows any other options besides shutdown, because under the budget, there's simply no money to run the coastal. The coastal runs, they are subsidized. I think the runs from Bellingham to Juneau in the summer are profitable, and they could continue to run under the governor's budget. He does have program receipts in the budget, and the thing that's not in the budget is subsidy for the smaller coastal runs.
And I think for Senator Schauer's question,
We'll be having DOT in front of us, including airports and Marine Highway, to go in further detail. We didn't, in the broader discussion here, we didn't have time to get into rural airports. So all that's coming attractions. Senator Bishop, did you flag me?
No, thank you. You covered it. You just covered it. Thank you.
Senator Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Teal, have you received the program priority listing yet from OMB on these departments on some of their reasons or may have some of their reasons for these expenditures and, or decreases?
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, no.
And just as a follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Follow-up.
And I guess this has the committee, or do we know when we're going to get that part of that release of the priority, the prioritization of the administration for the departments?
During the subcommittee process, Senator Wilson, the, hopefully those that prioritization will come forward. There's a spot in everybody's binder to put that prioritization in, and DO or OMB has said several times here at the committee that they'll bring forward to that subcommittee process, so the subcommittee chairman and subcommittees can go through that. Any other questions for, on this slide?
Any? Mr. Chairman, I should qualify that. We do have agencies that have set priorities, but those priorities are, you know, things like number one, number two. There's no justification that I'm aware of for why those decisions were made. Even getting that's an improvement over what typically comes out of the agencies where they've often simply refused to prioritize programs in a way that you might like them prioritized, so that it gets to Senator Schauer's point of what's discretionary and how discretionary is it. Those decisions are very difficult for you as a body to make without information from the executive branch. And I think it's clear that this year the executive branch will be providing more of that priority information than you've received in the past. But as Senator Stedman says, I think you'll see that by the time you get to subcommittee. I know that agencies are likely to be asked as part of the subcommittee process to provide impact statements by program saying what these cuts will do to their programs, how they expect to manage with the money they have.
Okay, we have other questions on slide number six. Okay, seeing none, we'll go on to the next slide, please.
Okay, the agency overviews that you had so far, I think, give you a really good start on subcommittee work, and I didn't really intend to spend that much time on the agencies, but it's, you know, if there are questions on them, I'm happy to answer them or try to. So before we go on to some of the bigger issues, I'd just like to make a comment on some of the blogs, the media, where comments to some of the articles have said, well, Ledge Finance Division claims that balancing the budget would eliminate agencies were nothing more than scare tactics, that the budget's balanced as submitted by the governor and the agencies still exist. So nothing more than scare tactics. Don't believe we have a problem. The point of that slide showing how what $1.6 billion in cuts would look like wasn't that I expected agencies to vanish under the governor's budget. I didn't. It was to show that agency budgets were not good hunting ground for finding $1.6 billion in cuts. And I think the governor's budget proves that point by proposing only about $260 million in cuts, many of them unvetted. So slide six left us with a number, with a question. If agency operating budgets weren't the means of balancing the budget, what was? Slide seven explains how you get to $1.6 billion. It shows the reductions here of the non-formula cuts to agencies, plus education and early development, health and social services. You can substitute K-12 here if you want. It's essentially the same thing. It's probably worth mentioning on K-12 that when the OMB director was in front of you, she mentioned that, well, governments contribute to K-12 as well. And if that was meant to imply that UGF cuts can be offset by increased local contributions, or if that's what you got out of her statement, that's not necessarily the way it works. Local government does contribute to education in two ways. One is mandatory contributions. That's based on property tax values, and that won't be affected by state funding in any way. It's affected by the value of the property taxes and the required 2.65 mils that the state requires them to levy on property and contribute to school districts. The other part of local contributions is the voluntary side. And it may seem that, well, if you lose state money, you simply increase your voluntary contributions. However, voluntary contributions have a cap. It's 23% of basic need, which even without getting into the complications of basic need versus state funding, it's the amount of money that the state gives the districts. And if you're going to cut state funding by 25%, then voluntary contributions, the cap on voluntary contributions, also goes down by 23%. So that if you're Anchorage or Juneau and you're funding at the maximum to the cap, then your voluntary contributions must fall. So that in addition to losing state funds, you're also losing local funds. Now, if you're Mat-Su or several of the other districts that do not fund to the cap, then you may not lose any local funding. But there you get into the other complications of, well, if you are hit with the state not reimbursing your school debt so that you have less local money available to spend, then that may reduce your voluntary contributions to school districts. That's something we don't know. Every district, every community might treat that differently. It's just that school funding is not as simple as if you lose state funding, local governments will step up and contribute more. They may, but they may not be able to do that. So the cuts were anticipated in some areas, and they're consistent with the governor's opinion that we spend too much money. But you may ask whether the remainder of the budget proposal is consistent with the governor's principles. And here we see one principle was no new revenue. But here we see, I've listed them as cost shifts to local governments. Some shifts the state avoids an expense, like shifting debt service reimbursement onto local governments. That's a reduction of state expenditures. It's a shift to local governments. There are some shifts that do not save the state money. They bring in state revenue. And petroleum property tax would be in that category, where local governments now keep $400 million of petroleum property tax that they would not be able to keep under the governor's budget proposal. Shared taxes, $28 million, is money that the state now shares with local communities but wouldn't under the governor's proposals. School debt reimbursement is, again, money that goes out to local governments, but would not under the governor's proposal. And that's $68 million in unrestricted general funds, but it's $106 million in total funds. There are some school funds and other funds that are used for that purpose. So the impact on local governments will be $106 million, but only $68 million of that is unrestricted general funds. And then there are some debt service that shifted on to municipalities or to electrical and other cooperatives the state will no longer be making or reimbursing the debt, and so that debt has to be picked up by local government or whoever it gets transferred to. The governor suggested that he didn't want to use reserves, yet the bill pulls $172 million from the statutory budget reserve account, and it pulls $264 million from reserves held by state corporations. This is a little complicated because the governor crosses fiscal years with these appropriations, so let me explain. On Medicaid, which we skipped up here because I also address it down here, the governor cuts $249 million from Medicaid, but then he restores much of the money in a way that's less than transparent. The steps are that you appropriate $172 million from reserve funds in fiscal year 19. That means they don't count as an FY20 expenditure. However, they're available in 19 and allowed to carry forward into 20 and 21. Well, you might think that that's just a normal supplemental, except that the Department of Health and Social Services requested $15 million for Medicaid supplemental and continues to say that that's all the money they will need, and it's in the supplemental bill. So that this $172 million would not be used in FY19. It counts as an expenditure in 19, but it actually will be carried forward into FY20. So now, using that money is contingent upon approval of certain waivers and other items by CMS, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, and I think you've probably heard Health and Social Services testify about this, and I think you had questions about the approval process because I think you understand that they don't approve anything very quickly, and that it's, in our opinion, highly unlikely that these approvals would come during the fiscal year, certainly not by July 1st, and so that we see the $172 million in reserve use as being near certain. And in fact, if the CMS approval doesn't come, we're looking at supplemental appropriations of $70 million or more if you follow the governor's proposals. So, our recommendation is that you do not use the budget reserves. You can reduce the $172 million in FY20, but it's likely to simply increase the supplemental by that amount. So if you're going to follow your typical path, which is we would like to avoid supplemental funding when we believe or know that we're underfunding a program, then that would require you to add $172 million or more to Medicaid in your budget, your version of the budget. The $260 million of ADA receipts are spent directly. $84 million of it is spent in FY19. These are to go into the account that you use to purchase oil tax credit certificates. And the $84 million in 19 is to make up for a shortage in 19. I should point out, though, that although the 19 minimum statutory requirement, at least under the Department of Revenue's interpretation, was $184 million, you appropriated $100 million last year. You also appropriated $27 million for debt service. So what the governor is asking for is the additional $84 million to make FY19 purchases. But you could simply repurpose that $27 million for debt service, which has not been used since bonds were not issued, and the legal challenge to them is still unresolved, and use that to purchase credits if you choose to do that. I think we can probably ignore the legal and credit rating issues of taking money from ADA and just focus on transparency. Excess cash held by state corporations is reserves. And the source of those reserves is the unrestricted general funds that were used to capitalize the corporation. So as with terminated loan programs, we prefer to see any recovery of the capitalization of loan funds or state corporations simply go back to the general fund and be spent as general funds. That way, the money shows in your budget. It shows as both revenue, and then it shows as an expenditure. As the budget's laid out now, ADA funding doesn't appear as revenue. It doesn't appear as UGF spending. It's simply invisible money. The bottom line is that less than half of the deficit, the $1.6 billion, is filled by expenditure reductions. And there are revenue and reserve actions that are unexpected, given the five principles that the governor outlined. I guess at this point you say, well, does consistency with principles matter? Does transparency matter? And you can argue that the governor should submit another bill, a bill that doesn't cross fiscal years, it doesn't use reserves, it doesn't shift costs to local governments, it doesn't propose cuts that the legislature may not wish to implement. But I wouldn't be shocked if amendments addressed, I'd be shocked if amendments did address those issues. In the oft-repeated refrain from Donna Ardwin and other representatives of OMB is any indication, the governor's response will be, it's just a proposal. The less stated portion of that response is, but if you don't accept the governor's proposals, you need to find alternative reductions because you have to balance the budget just like I balance the budget. Well, that leaves you in a bit of a box, because if you don't like the tax changes in the governor's bill, you don't like the using reserves, and you don't like some of the reductions that he's proposed, how are you going to balance the budget? Your tool list is unchanged. You can use reserves. You know that's not a long-term solution. It can get you through the session. Revenue measures, I don't know that revenue measures will be proposed in the legislature, whether they'd get through the legislature, whether they'd survive a veto if they did. You can cut agency expenditures, but that's proven to be just as difficult as we anticipated it would be. You can cut statewide items. I think there's some room there for some savings in retirement costs and tax credits, but it's not enough to balance the budget. You can cut PFDs, and you know the trade-offs there. Dividends compete with other government expenditures, but that doesn't, knowing those things doesn't make those decisions any easier. At one end of the spectrum, the governor says that a PFD of less than $3,000 is not an option. At the other end, people note that there would be a surplus if we didn't pay PFDs. leading them to conclude that we don't have a fiscal problem, we have a political problem. However you define the problem, you have tough decisions, and that requires some strong supporting justification for any proposals you have. When I saw the budget, I immediately wondered, well, these are some major changes in policy. Where are the supporting documents? Looking at the lack of justification, I began to wonder whether the budget was designed in some way to create chaos, so that the legislature may say, well, there's just so much going on here. We've got 16 pieces of legislation and that we haven't even seen yet. In response to the earlier question, I should have probably mentioned that, no, we don't have that analysis done on which bills affect budgets by how much, because we haven't even seen the bills yet. We haven't had a chance to look at fiscal notes. We know that some things can be done through the appropriation process, that some things can't. We have some legislation that modifies things, but we also see that it's done in the budget process already. So it's going to take a while to straighten out how the legislation meshes with the budget. So there are all kinds of bills to review that we're not ready with. And I don't know, maybe it's just, if you have enough in front of you, maybe there's some hope on the governor's part that you'll just throw up your hands and say, we don't have time to evaluate this. We'll just go along with what the governor proposes because we don't have much of a way to come up with alternatives. We don't have the time. So, or maybe creating chaos is just a clever way to force a conversation that needs to happen, or that he believes needs to happen, in order to move forward. Maybe people are going to see these budget reductions that are required to pay a $3,000 dividend, and they're going to say, come in and plead with the governor, plead with the legislature to reduce the dividend in order to avoid the consequences of the budget reductions. I don't know. I can say that.
Before we go on to this next slide, do we have questions on slide number 7? Senator Michiki.
Thank you, Mr. Teal. On the line, school debt reimbursement, I just, because of the Casale case, it leads me to believe that perhaps capital is a part of the cap when it comes to school locals providing additional funding. Does that line also then impact the education and early development local reduction?
Through the chair, it doesn't. My understanding of the school debt reimbursement bill is that it reduces the payments to municipalities, but the Casale case revolved around the state requirements to provide rural schools. That's done with the REAA, the Regional Education Attendance Areas fund, that is based upon the amount of money that goes towards school debt and putting a proportionate amount towards rural schools. Well, that formula breaks when your school debt reimbursement to local governments goes to zero, then the deposits for rural schools would also go to zero. There's a provision in that bill that says we're going to put money towards rural schools anyway. So Casale should be addressed, I believe. But the other part of your question on affecting local government finances is no, it affects the amount of money that a municipality has to contribute to school districts. but it's not a necessary connection. If Anchorage implemented a sales tax, for instance, they could increase their voluntary local contributions if the sales tax more than offset the loss of school debt reimbursement.
We have other questions. Do you have a follow-up?
So why wouldn't there be a reverse lawsuit if urban schools were disadvantaged with the administration paying for the cost for the rural schools?
Mr. Chairman, did you see the look Senator Hoffman just gave me?
That legislation may or may not go forward, so. But we'll have, when we have Department of Ed in front of us and we talk about the education and the debt reimbursement, I'm sure that subject's going to come up, the Casale case and implications of it. So we have Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Senator Stedman. There's just so much to talk about here, and I just want to go to using reserves for now, Mr. Teal. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. ADA, is that reoccurring? Do you think that will be reoccurring use of ADA revenues going forward by this administration?
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, no, I don't think it can be. There was a report produced that said ADA has substantial cash reserves. I think this would take half of it, or maybe a little more than half of those reserves, so that it cannot be a continuing thing. I think you'd have to consider this a one-time thing, and I say that after listening to some testimony in the House about the impacts of reducing ADA reserves, the concept being that ADA as an economic development, it's ADA is Alaska Industrial Development
Authority.
Yeah, authority. So they help finance economic development in the state. And in the House, one said, well, we have banks. Banks will lend, but ADA is often a participant in those project funding. And without ADA funding, you're removing a lot of capital available that funds private development. So even taking this amount of reserves from ADA may affect the money that's available for private sector development.
Thank you for that, Mr. Teal, because you just answered my follow-up question to the public. I hope they were listening.
Senator Schauer.
Thank you, Chair. Trying to get my arms around the UGF, DGF, and then required versus discretionary spending we're talking to. Can I get from your department a breakdown of the DGF, the sources, so that we have an idea of just what's required and discretionary from that question I asked before? We can follow up with you if you would provide it. That's fine. Just trying to get that information. So
your question is you want a breakdown from on ADA?
No, this is regarding DGF, just the sources. So which ones they have, if they're actually tracking that, if you are.
Mr. Chairman, I can follow up with Senator Schauer's office and get him what he needs.
Lots of that information. So. Other questions on this slide? Senator Von Imhoff.
Mr. Teal, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can you talk about the interplay of the SBR and how you utilized it in the health and social service net? You have $132 million up there after using $172 million from the SBR, so that's the net. And then the SBR is also incorporated again using reserves, second line SBR for Medicaid, $172. I'm sure the math works. I'm just not sure because it looks like we're incorporating it under the health and social services, so showing it's a net, then we're adding it again below. How does the math work?
And if you could start that by defining what the SBR is for those at home and why we would use that source of funds for the targeted usage, I guess, in this budget proposal.
Mr. Chairman, the SBR is the statutory budget reserve fund. It is it's intended to be used as a shock absorber. It's in that sense, it's similar to the constitutional budget reserve. The major difference being that the constitutional budget reserve requires a supermajority to spend. The statutory budget reserve can be spent with a simple majority. Now, the cuts to health and social services total over $300 million, and I reduced it up on under reductions in agencies by the 172 because it's counted down here. And I thought it's more appropriate to say that's a use of reserves. The fact that it was, and you point out, make a good point here, that the reserves are used up here. So health and social services cut was 132 and then the additional 172, so slightly over $300 million. You saw on this slide that $87 million of that is non-formula. The Medicaid portion of it is about $249 million, so the numbers do work out, but you could just as well have said up here that health and social services has cut $300 million. If you'd counted the reserves as savings up here, then they wouldn't appear as using the reserves. And I guess the point I'm trying to make here is that despite saying that the governor wanted to preserve and maintain our reserves, that he is in fact using them.
Mr. Chairman, on that point.
Yes, Senator Hoffman.
On that point, the numbers only work for 1 year. What amount of funds will be left after, if this one were implemented, after the expenditure of $172 million from the SBR? How much would be left in the SBR?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, zero.
So that's my point. The numbers work, but they only work for 1 year.
Any other questions on this slide? Okay, go ahead and continue on to the next slide, please.
This slide was really aimed at perhaps the conversation that is being caused by the budget proposal. And these are just some of the questions that I think I'm not sure that people are aware of. The dividend consumes 37% of our revenue. That's, to me, an astonishing number that we could spend over a third of all the money that's available to us is handed out as dividends. But the second is the proposed budget, UGF budget, proposed by the governor, is only really $123 million, which is 2% below the FY19 budget. That's dividends included as an expenditure.
Just for clarification for those at home, the dividend amount you're talking about is a statutory formula-driven dividend of roughly $3,000 per person upcoming in the fall?
Correct, Mr. Chairman. The dividend amount budgeted or proposed by the governor is $1.9 billion.
Okay. Go ahead and continue.
So reductions to agency operating budgets address only about $650 million of the $1.6 billion deficit. And as you saw, the remainder of the deficit is filled by shifting costs to local government or draining reserves. And one thing I wanted to mention here was that on the economic impact of these cuts, Director Ardwin and others came in and mentioned the position counts. saying that the job losses in the budget position reductions are approximately 350 from FY19, but that excludes 600 jobs on the Marine Highway system if it shuts down. You heard the Jim Johnson, university president, say that the university impacts could be 1,300 jobs. And if the reduction to K-12 goes through, then that could cause a loss of 3,000 jobs in school districts or more. So that we're really looking at 5,000 jobs. And it depends on how you count. These are direct. And I think you're going to have ICER and perhaps Department of Labor and OMB economists come in, and they can talk more about the indirect economic impact of this. I'm just looking at, we're looking at 5,000 jobs that are direct losses in government, and I consider government to be state, local, and school district, because school districts are funded by government. So you're looking at significant job loss, and I don't know when the economists are coming, but that should be a real interesting discussion.
Mr. Teal, for that, just for the information of the committee and the public, it's highly likely we'll start that process next week. Go ahead and let him finish the slide, and then we'll come to questions.
So I don't have any answers to any of these questions. I don't know what the governor's intentions or the desire of the citizens may be. But I have some additional questions that you may be very interested in getting the governor's feedback on, and that's whether his other budget principles, specifically the permanent fund dividend, is as flexible as the principle, if he's as flexible on that as he has been on use of reserves and having new revenue. The other question I have is relates to the bills. With that many bills, we don't know if they're all of equal priority. I hope we have the time to analyze each of them, but that's an awful lot of fiscal analysis on those bills. So I hope he can prioritize those bills. I know that governors typically submit only a few bills. They can focus on shepherding them through, and with so many bills, I don't know if he's going to be pushing hard on all of them, or where you stand on hearing and passing his bills. I would say that we still have a fairly weak understanding of where the budget intends to take the state, and whether the budget proposals will stand up to scrutiny once we do have time to begin the analysis.
And before we go on to that slide, we have questions from the committee then. Senator Wilikowski, Senator Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I could probably say the same thing about oil tax credits, which according to the revenue sources book consume in FY 2020 $1.9 billion, which is the same amount as the dividend. But my question is, how are you defining revenue there? Are you including earnings, corporate earnings? Are you including earnings from the permanent fund?
Through the chair, Senator, we're looking at revenue as being primarily the two tax changes. That's the petroleum property tax, which requires legislation, and that would generate about $420 million to the Treasury, but of course it takes it from local governments. And there's another $28 million of shared taxes, which does not require legislation, that we currently spend in distributing the money to local government, and does not require legislation to implement that change.
You have a follow-up?
Yeah, just on your point number one there, you say dividends consume 37% of revenue. That was the revenue I was referring to.
Oh, okay.
Sir.
That includes the traditional oil revenue. It also includes the entire POMV payout, both the amount for dividends and the amount that the general fund retains.
Okay, we'll go to Senator Wilson.
Yeah, just follow up on the fifth bullet point here. We don't know if the UA system or the school districts will actually cut those 4,300 jobs. We just know that's the amount of the proposed cuts. They could restructure in any shape, way, or form that they choose to reshape to handle any reduction. But I just don't like we can frame this conversation in many ways, Mr. Chair, that I just think that sometimes we frame it in the most drastic nuclear option there is to for shock and appeal.
Okay. We're going to have a quick response to that. The solidness that you feel your numbers are on the job loss?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Wilson is correct. We don't know. We're using some kind of rule of thumb here that I think it's the same one that the university used, which is approximately $100,000 per job. I don't know how accurate that is. And of course, Senator Wilson is correct. They can restructure. What we're doing is simply translating dollar cuts into positions at roughly $100,000 per position.
Fine, we'll have some economists to talk about that. Senator Bishop.
I'll yield. I'll save my argument, counter-argument, when the economists get here on that point.
Okay, we have Senator Olson and Senator Machicki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Teal, I realize you're not necessarily a policy analyst, and that's not what your job title is there, but you've been with the state for 30 years and been the director for 20 years as the legislative finance person that is here. As you looked over the years of governors putting budgets forward, and we look at this as, and I'm assuming you're agreeing that this is the most unrealistic budget we've ever seen come down the pike. There are two of us that have been here at the table for over 20 years. A lot of it's dependent on proposed legislation that may or may not go through and probably won't go through. I guess how crippling is it to the state of Alaska as we look at some of these issues? Let's take, for example, the health and social services where you have TB control, vaccines that are being interrupted because of the public health nursing program not being fully implemented, where vaccines for diseases like meningitis are not necessarily going to be monitored. As you look at the university where we're already seeing students that are saying they're not coming back because of the uncertain future and faculty that are leaving. We look at the issue of the petroleum property tax. You've touched on it already, which is affecting the bond rating now of the North Slope Borough, as they may have some of their bonding called in early because of an agreement that's within their bonding measure. Even the marine highway system that is out there that is going to be essentially mothballed, like we look at the aircraft carriers from World War II. My question, if you remember, and I'll bring it back to that, how crippling is this to, and how unrealistic is this, or have you ever seen anything like it in your 20 or 30 years of being with the state?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, I know I've never seen anything like this, but when you say unrealistic, I look at it as not unrealistic in budgetary terms. I mean, these cuts can be made. The revenue measures can be adopted. The unrealistic part of the budget to me is any expectation that you have enough time to really consider these, especially given the fact that the information's not available to you now. I mean, I look at this as a case of biting off way more than you can chew, not just on the governor's part, where there are a lot of proposals, but those proposals aren't really vetted. You can't be presented with position papers with justification at this time. And what that does is throw an unrealistic workload on the legislature, because you would have a difficult time, even if all this analysis that you need to make decisions was available right now. The fact that OMB has implied that that's not their job, to provide the backup, the information that you need. It's your job to vet these proposals. I find that completely unrealistic, that in a regular session, which we're now, approaching halfway, that you would be able to get this analysis done, interpret it, and make decisions.
Senator Machicki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Your number two talks about the 2% reduction in UGF, yet slide number six reflects a 13% reduction. I guess UGF, I think of it as it coming out of the pockets of every Alaskan. DGF comes out of the pockets of some Alaskans. This dovetails on Senator Schauer's question earlier. We really need to see it clarified on how that breaks out on the 13% reduction, so that Alaskans can see which ones it would affect and how it would affect them. Is that something you do plan to provide to the committee so that we can clarify those impacts?
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, the difference in the numbers is it's a 13% reduction in the agency operating costs. That's all that was on this slide. It is not Medicaid cuts. It is not K-12 cuts. It's just the essentially non-formula agency operations. The 123 million 2% cut referred to in number two on this slide is all UGF, not just non-formula, but the formula cuts, the capital budget, the fund transfers, everything rolled up into a fiscal summary. So at that level, you're looking at a 2% reduction rather than a 13% reduction.
Follow-up, and then the Bishop.
Just a brief follow-up, and that is just thinking about the university budget. The budget shows almost no reduction in the university budget. However, there's a huge shift to DGF. So I think it's important that those are separated out for Alaskans to understand those impacts.
Okay. Senator Bishop.
Thanks. I'd just like to go back to your earlier comment there, to Senator Olson's question, and just I'd like to add, you said unrealistic workload on the legislature. I think it's an unrealistic workload on the executive branch as well. I don't think they got the horsepower either to try to move 24 pieces of legislation through the building.
Okay. Senator Schauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple points, and I do have a question. I think we're mixing a little bit of positions versus jobs and the employees, as Senator Wilson was talking about. The previous DOA designee commissioner and the current one I just talked to yesterday both said around 3,100. She actually said 3,064. Of budgeted but unfilled positions currently. So there's room, and I know that's not static. I just wanted to point that out. The other point is that as we're talking about the dividend, and I believe Senator Wilikowski was mentioning this, is that it was DGF. It was in that designated category, and that language was changed recently to put it into the UGF. So we're now putting it out there where it is available as revenue, and I understand it's a point of view. When you're talking, the question I have is that when you're talking about DGF, UGF, et cetera, and we're focusing a lot on UGF, it would seem that it would make sense, and I'm trying to frame this as a question, that it kind of makes the point that we want to discuss everything in terms where I know there's been a little bit of a divergence maybe of opinion between yourself and the OMB director of all money being green and how we either combine it and talk about it all as UGF or DGF. But doesn't that kind of make the point as we're having these discussions that we need to discuss all of them, UGF, DGF, and other, to have that broad kind of overview for the Alaskan people so they see it all?
To the chair, Senator Schauer, I think that it is important to look at all kinds of money, it's also important to understand that it's not all the same. And you know, all we need to do is look at the university, and no reason to beat that horse again. DGF versus UGF, again, UGF is real money. DGF turns into money if you can collect it. Regarding the classification of dividends as DGF, there was a time when the earnings reserve account had a designated purpose, and that was to pay dividends and to pay inflation proofing. It was not used for government. We argued about the classification for many years because the Constitution and budgeting says that the earnings reserve account is UGF. It can be spent at any time for any purpose. That's the definition of UGF. We didn't classify it as UGF because dividends were considered to be kind of below the line. We put them on the fiscal summary, but we didn't roll them up into any totals. And that changes under SB 26. As soon as you say that there's a payout from the permanent fund earnings reserve account that can be used for general government purposes, then the earnings reserve account is very clearly identified as unrestricted general fund revenue. And any spending from it, including dividends, also becomes unrestricted general fund revenue. You can see why that happens because of the relationship between dividends and revenue. If there's $3 billion in payout, the 5.25% gives you $3 billion in payout, you can either pay dividends with that, and whatever you don't use for dividends goes to the general fund. Your dividend is a choice. The amount that you pay for dividends is a choice that you make. So that if you paid $1 billion in dividends, then general fund revenue becomes $2 billion. You spend $2 billion on dividends, then the general fund revenue falls to $1 billion. So it's simply impossible to continue to call dividends DGF. It is not designated any longer. The unrestricted general fund is where the money goes. It's where the payout goes. It's the amount that goes to the UGF is affected by the amount on dividends. So it just kind of loops through. I realize that many people believe that changing the accounting of the permanent fund is the reason for the deficit, maybe. It has nothing to do with the change in category, I guess.
So let's go on to the last slide.
Okay.
Pretty much work that slide. Let's go on. This is the last slide, I think, in the presentation. We got 15 minutes left.
Okay. Slide 9 compares the 19 budget to the FY20 request. And the total reduction here is the $123 million, or 2%, that we just talked about. The takeaway should be that even though there's about $1 billion of the deficit that was filled by using reserves or getting new revenue, the $650 million in proposed cuts falls pretty much as we anticipated. The small bars, where we said, you know, there's no money here, not enough money to fill a deficit unless you entirely eliminate state government. Well, those bars didn't change much. You know, minus 1%, 2%, 3%, there's some increases, 1% changes. Basically, it's unchanged down here. The cuts hit the big money programs pretty much as we anticipated, and not these hits are not just in larger in dollar amounts, you'd expect that. It's a larger program. There are also much larger in percentage reductions, so that K-12 has a 28% reduction in funding. Dividends are up $900 million, 90%. Medicaid is down 38% statewide, primarily due to the reduction of school debt reimbursement, is down 33%, and you know, you have another 18 and 41. So it isn't a surprise to us, and it probably isn't a surprise to you, that the governor did cut where the money is. And where the money is what many people would classify as core services. As Senator Murkowski said, the core services are education, health care, access to transportation. And this budget hits those core services hard.
Senator Bonimoff.
Thank you, Chair Stedman. So taking your comments with the previous slide about how the dividend should be more viewed in UGF, and then you're looking at this slide, this is UGF, and you had indicated earlier dividends consume 37% of the revenue. If you look at UGF total spend, what percentage is the dividends of the entire UGF spend?
Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, it's if you follow the budget, the percentages are exactly the same, because you end up with with no deficit, no surplus. So revenue is equal to expenditures. So 37% of revenue and 37% of expenditures.
If I may. How I looked at it was, if you look at what was being allocated, if UGF spend only, it was about $3.5 billion for all the agencies. If we're going to be spending $1.9 billion on to pay a $3,000 dividend, that's consuming about, that would be, in essence, 54% of the agency spending equivalent to paying a dividend. So,
through the chair, you can, that's a valid number as well. We included the dividend spending as part of the total. If you wanted to remove it, you can run the numbers that way.
Other questions? Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, I would agree with Senator Schauer. I have never viewed the earnings reserve, and even after SB 26, I don't view it as UGF. But is the permanent fund dividend actually in the governor's 2020 amended budget? I didn't see it in there.
Through the chair, I think the governor has an interesting definition of the budget. He has said or implied that the dividend is not in the budget, and it is in SB 23. So you have an appropriation bill. I think it's coming before this committee fairly soon. I think it's being heard in other committees. But you do have an appropriation bill for the dividend. I look at the budget as, it's not simply the operating bill or the operating and capital bill. The budget is the full fiscal plan. It includes all revenue measures that might be changed. It includes any of the bills that might affect either appropriations themselves or fiscal notes are part of the budget. And then all appropriations, regardless of whether they're in the capital bill, the operating bill, the mental health, or any other appropriation bill, it makes no difference which bill an appropriation is in. It's still an expenditure. So I would argue that the governor's budget includes all appropriation bills, including the SB 23, which appropriates the $1.9 billion for dividends.
Okay, we have follow-up questions on this slide? Seeing none, Senator Kalski, have another.
Just real quick.
Kalski, have another question?
I guess, I mean, he's got an appropriation bill where he's seeking the back payment of prior PFDs, but that's an appropriation request, but that's not included in this chart.
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, those back payments would not use FY20 money. The back payments would be made in FY21, 22, and 23. So this chart is limited to FY20 appropriations.
We have other questions from the committee. We got a couple more minutes. Seeing none, thank you for your presentation. Do you have any final quick comments before we wrap up?
Mr. Chair, I do. It's just more a matter of curiosity. You may notice that there's no language in the bill referring to a draw from the Constitutional Budget Reserve account. You may argue that none is necessary.
Let's be quiet. I can't hear him when there's too much chit-chatting. He might say something that's important.
I might.
I'm waiting for it. Okay, back on the record. Go ahead, Mr. Teal. We were referencing some issue that may not be in the operating budget that we should.
Well, the Constitutional Budget Reserve is not mentioned in the operating budget. And you may say that you don't need a reference to the CBR, the Constitutional Budget Reserve, because there's no deficit, therefore no draw. I'd point out a couple things here. First is that, if you did the governor's proposal exactly, or budget exactly as proposed, and you had a $20 million surplus, all it takes is a 50-cent change in the price of oil to throw you in, or decline in the price of oil, to throw you into deficit territory. Then what do you do? The CBR has no access. The SBR is gone. You have no automatic way to fill the deficit, which brings you back in special session, apparently, in order to address a shortfall in revenue. I know that's the way many states address revenue shortfalls, but I think that's pretty inefficient, and think that you do need some statement regarding how you fill a deficit. Other states can get away without it because their revenue is far more stable than ours. Ours is the most volatile revenue stream in the country by far, so that we can't count on our projections being accurate. The second issue is that there's no reverse sweep. And I think people at the table probably know that when what we refer to as the reverse sweep is the provision of the Constitution that says at the end of every year, if there's a liability to the Constitutional Budget Reserve, then all the money in the general fund and all of its subfunds are swept into the CBR. And the reverse sweep is a provision that's in the budget every year that says all the money we swept from the subfunds is put back where it belonged or where it was. And if you don't do that, you run into issues with the Worker Safety Fund, for instance, which runs a good share of the Department of Labor. That funding is lost. It causes all kinds of accounting problems. And even in years when the supermajority vote was controversial, the reverse sweep has never been a very controversial vote. I think legislators have always understood that that's not really a big policy call. It's simply helping the administration avoid nightmare accounting issues by not having money available to them. So it's not a subcommittee item by any means, but it's something that you as a committee may want to deal with when you begin looking at a committee substitute.
Any other comments before we wrap up?
Okay, tomorrow, 9 a.m., we're going to have a confirmation hearing on Commissioner Designee Shibaka for the Department of Administration. So 9 a.m. tomorrow morning. Thanks, everybody, for coming. We are adjourned.